Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck, joined by Shad Marquitz again, my co-host. We are going to be focusing on, again, the resource sector, but also having some comments on the U.S. equity markets, which continue to show strength even in the face of a lot of bearish calls. But boy, oh boy, that rotation into tech and more growth stocks continues. And unfortunately for the metals, well, they're stuck, and gold continues to be in this downtrend. So Shad and I are kicking off this show with Eric Wetterling, founder and editor of The Hedgeless Horseman. Now, Eric, let's start off with just a general comment on how you're playing this continued downtrend for gold and the gold stocks in terms of your portfolio management. We were chatting off mic before recording, and you mentioned that you are more diversified than ever, of course, in the resource sector. How has that come to be, Eric? Why are you more diversified right now? And what are you diversified across in terms of stocks?
The simple answer is that I still, and I've been saying this for I don't know how long. I mean, I think especially the junior miners, especially the gold junior miners, are very much undervalued relative to gold. And of course, right now, the sentiment is awful. I mean, we had a 11-month correction or whatever, and there's been a ton of times where it feels like, okay, now the a bull is going to resume, and then it gets sold off, and we hit an lower low and a lower low and a lower low. And recently we actually had a higher high, and then that got basically someone took a bat to the knee again, and down we went. So I mean, I'm just looking at what people are saying on Twitter. It's really dreadful. I mean, people are really down, commenting and tweeting about gold, etc., or miners overall. I mean, the sentiment is really horrible. So that usually means that the junior miners are very cheap, and I think they are very cheap. I mean, I remember when I was dreaming about $1,400 gold. And like I said previously, I mean, if someone asked me, given where the valuations of the juniors are trading, would I guess that gold was at 1771 right now? No way that I would have guessed that. I might have said like, yeah, around 1400 or whatever. So, and to the point of diversification, I mean, I don't like diversification for diversification's sake. I'm very diversified now because there are so many great risk reward setups, in my opinion. So I don't feel like I'm losing out too much on quality and getting the benefit of actually being diversified, because nowadays I'm so diversified that I don't really follow any particular company on any given day. I mean, what the stock is doing, etc. So I mean, that in terms of quality of life, I think that's great. And again, since there are so many bargains, I mean, that's the whole reason that I feel like, I don't see the real trade-off. Because if we go back to 2016-17 or whatever, when gold was at 1300-1400 and juniors were even higher than they are now, I mean, in that point in time, I think there were a bunch of overvalued juniors, and that means that sentiment was high and the amount of bargains was relatively low. So in that case, I actually had to concentrate, let's say, and do real due diligence to find the ones that weren't really overvalued, still undervalued, and then I would just pile into them. But now I can pick 40, 50 juniors or whatever that I think actually are cheap. I mean, there will be differences, etc. But again, it's like I could invest with a shotgun right now, in my opinion. I could make X amount of portfolios if I had to pick 10 companies each, and I think everyone would outperform GDXJ, for example. So I just think it's, it's like Christmas out there.
Well, Eric, you raise a couple interesting points there. So on your portfolio, you're saying you're more diversified than ever. But we're also noting that the sentiment is pretty down after a correction in the precious metals for an extended period of time. So a lot of people have told us they get more selective during this time period. They get rid of their optionality plays. They get rid of their higher risk things, and they go into safer names, and they go into names that they know are going to rebound, or maybe get some of that first investor, that generalist investor inflows, the bigger producers, or some of the ones that are included in GDX, GDXJ, SILJ, et cetera. But you're saying you're more diversified than ever, and you've added more names at more of a shotgun approach because you believe most of them are going to have plenty of upside and outperform the indexes. So you're saying you're more diversified now and maybe less selective on the quality because you feel there's so much upside left. And you also made the point that compared to where the metals are and where they were the last cycle, they're still undervalued. So are you more diversified into, you're saying a shotgun approach, but are you looking at mostly exploration plays, or do you like the development plays where they have assets in the ground and you think that those will eventually get re-rated higher? Are you looking at any producers? Which kind of stocks are you in right now?
I mean, that's a good point. Because as we know, the COVID crash of 2020, I think it was around March, sentiment was obviously very bad at that point in time. And I mean, the whole feeling of the world is going to end, etc. But at that point in time, you actually had the tier one developers, etc. I'm thinking about Mag Silver, for example. They went down 60 to 70%. But you don't see Mag Silver trading at $5 per share, for example. So if I could go back and compare it to now, back then it was so the sentiment was so shit and it was a liquidity event, etc. That the very de-risked tier one projects were at fire sale prices. I don't see the same thing right now where there are, no-brainers where you could basically put in 100% of your portfolio in. And you almost, for sure know that you're going to at least have a double in relatively short order. Again, I think it's a different time frame right now. I do think the juniors themselves are more undervalued than the sector overall. But in the COVID crash, for example, everything went down. So I do see more alpha opportunity in companies with exploration potential, et cetera, because I have no idea how long this, correction is going to, keep ongoing. And if I don't see that I'm able to buy, let's say, Mag Silver for 70% off, et cetera, then I'm going to stick to the alpha plays because there's a whole bunch of juniors that have started to drill or will be drilling very soon. And in that case, I think that time is on my side, because even if we have a neutral gold and silver price for the next 6 months or whatever, I mean, if the companies I invest in have, pretty good return on investment in terms of their dollar spent, etc. So when the actual bull kicks off again, that's just going to be more leverage because the company has created more internal value. I don't really like optionality plays unless there's a liquidity event, because again, Mag Silver, it's not like I don't know it too well. So, I mean, as far as I know, it's not the, best growth case, let's say. But I mean, when that went down 60-70%, I mean, then it actually became a no brainer, because if there's one silver mine that's going to get built, et cetera, it's the tier one asset. So it's just a different time period. I see right now I'm more looking at and thinking that the juniors are broadly undervalued relative to the other ones. But back in the COVID crash, everything went down.
So Eric, when you're investing in some of these stocks, obviously you are, from what you're outlining, you're seeing stocks cheap right now. And that's a bit of a change from what we heard back at the tail end of the run at the tail end of last summer, when stocks were getting a little ahead of themselves, maybe, at least in terms of some of the juniors. And the argument was we aren't seeing M&A activity because, well, for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons being, the juniors did already have a run. Now that we've seen a broad pullback across the board in these stocks, do you think these lower prices in some of these stocks attract some more takeover options? Are you investing at all around the goal of finding takeovers?
No, not really. I mean, the thing, again, with mature plays is that you're really almost only waiting for either sentiment to shift or a takeover or whatever. So that you can't really control, obviously, because there isn't that much M&A, or at least haven't been. I mean, I don't know how many developers and proved up resources there are out there in total, but I know that not many get actually, you know, get taken over. And besides, I mean, let's say your favorite takeover candidate gets taken over with a 30% premium. Okay, sure. I mean, that's good and all. First of all, you don't know when that's going to happen. Second of all, you don't know if it will happen at all. And if you actually, you know, stick to companies where you think that they can, with their own money, create enough value that it could warrant a 30% increase. And if they are lucky to be able to do that, that's probably going to, you know, continue. Because if you make a discovery, obviously, I mean, if you make a discovery hole, that's probably not the only value creation that will, you know, come out, because they'll probably keep on drilling, etc. So I try to stick to the things that I can control. And I don't like the strategy of like hoping that some, you know, white knight or whatever is going to come in and save you. So I like I think I've said before, it's like, I am in this sector because I think we are in a long-term bull, but I try to pick companies like we are in a, you know, chronic bear market, and don't expect anyone to really save me, let's say. Because, I mean, a real discovery is going to turn some heads, even in a bad market. I mean, the poster child right now is like newfound gold. During the 11-month correction, or I think it was at least 7-8 months at the start, in the last correction, I mean, newfound gold just kept on plowing, because they kept, they had their discovery and then they just kept on hitting. So it's like, if you would have thought that, oh, I'm going to get out of newfound gold, if you knew for sure that gold was going to have a 8-month downtrend, you would still miss out on like 180% or whatever. So that's the stuff I like. It's like, okay, if you picked the right companies, you probably do okay even in a bear market. And if it's a bull market, you're probably going to do great. Whereas if you're in optionality place or mature place or whatever, that they can't really create much value internally, then you're just stuck with, you know, hoping the sentiment will get better, or, you know, that the miracle of a buyout comes along. And I don't think that's a, you know, a repeatable strategy, really.
Well, Eric, let me toss another idea back at you then. Because obviously, if an explorer hits and they do they put out some great drill results, that stock's going to move agnostic of the metals price, whether it's a good metals price environment or a bad metals price environment. If somebody makes a legitimate discovery like what Newfound Gold has done, and we've seen it many, many other times, they're going to run hot and they're going to get a lot of investor interest. But right now, it's mostly precious metals investors trading amongst themselves, as we say. But when the generalists come back in, they're a little bit more skeptical of, you know, the very smaller stocks, and they're going to pile into probably the larger producers or the royalty companies. So the developers are in this weird spot that I see, where they're not really getting valued anywhere close. I mean, not even close to where their economic studies are, but they also still are explorers. They also can still step out on their projects and make a discovery. They also can still find a satellite deposit. Sometimes they have two or three projects, and while one may be moving into construction, they may have a second one that starts hitting that becomes even more attractive or as attractive as the second one. So I often hear that there's nothing to do on these takeover plays but just wait for optionality, or wait for someone to come and buy it. But couldn't these developers still make great discoveries, and couldn't that still move the needle in those stocks?
I mean, that's a good point, because basically you're painting the picture of the perfect risk-reward play, basically. Something that has so much in terms of margin of safety, what's already been proven, because it's trading so cheap relative to what they already have, that it becomes, in some case, like an alpha play. Because, I mean, there are some companies, like you say, they are so overvalued that they could actually, you know, become a multi-bagger and they still wouldn't be overvalued. So then the odds are real on your side, because the risks are to the upside. And if they have additional exploration potential, I mean, the leverage on, if there's a tiny enterprise value, which is already backed like 6 times by what they already have on paper, obviously any additional exploration success will have incredible leverage to where you bought in. So, I mean, those are the best cases, at least when you're talking about having a more concentrated portfolio there. So I see those kind of plays like the cornerstone positions or whatever. Like when I pick companies for the family, etc., those are typically the ones I choose. But that I do want to see something on the upside still, because I mean, if you have a mature project that is very boring, let's say, and there seems to be no real interest from any acquirer or whatever, if you can't make the project better, that, you know, is kind of a bad sign, because, okay, there's no way to reach that perhaps critical threshold where a larger company would actually acquire. But if you find the cases like you're suggesting that have that significant margin of safety, and the project could become bigger and probably then also more high quality, that's like the perfect storm. I mean, in an ideal world, those would be your only place, basically, because I mean, it's more fun to be in grassroots or early stage explorers, but they don't really have any margin of safety. I mean, if you had a portfolio of only exploration plays, theoretically, even though it's unlikely, you could have end up in a bull market having no gold or silver. So again, when it comes to risk reward and the value of actually compounding, because you can't compound a loss, the place you just described, they are the best place to be, all things considered.
Well, Eric, all things considered, let's just say that there's somebody out there and they don't have the ability to have a big diversified portfolio. They maybe are looking at this as an opportunity to position in some of these stocks that have sold down. Maybe share with us a couple of stocks that you're looking at right now that even if you already have a position and you're not personally adding, you think are at an attractive place to add because of key catalysts they have or just where they're at. Maybe they're too beaten down. Is there a couple stocks you have your eye on that look like really good value and you wish you had a ton more money to dump into them?
Well, if we're talking like more conservative risk reward, et cetera, then I think, for example, Rookmaster Resources looks like a no-brainer to me because that project is already big and it looks like it could be huge and it's really cheap. And I think it's mostly punished because the company has to pay like $40 million to get the fully acquired the project. But I mean, $40 million when it comes to that product, I think that's, you know, someone's gonna pay that for sure. Then I think like Magna Gold is pretty interesting. They just reached full production at their first mine, and they have a bunch of other projects. It's not the best mine in the world, but I mean, that's some when it based on the sum of its parts, I think it's really cheap. White Rock Minerals, I think, is really cheap. They're acquiring a small scale mine and they have a bunch of projects. Nova Resources, I've been adding that one recently for the first time in a while because their shares in Newfound Gold, I mean, it's starting to back a significant portion of the enterprise value and they are ramping up Beaton's Creek. Then we have like. What could I find more? I mean, yeah. I mean, I have a whole list. I'm trying to be as conservative as I can because I mean, I'm in the more riskier portion of the sector. Dolly Warden Silver, for example. I mean, that one has come down. They have like 22 million, I think, Canadian in cash. Enterprise value is kind of low. It's the lowest it's been in a while. So I mean, I think if you're a silver bull, for example, I mean, I see bad headlines in terms of jurisdiction risk all the time now, it seems. So I've been trying to focus more on jurisdiction. If you like silver, I think Dolly Warden is, you know, a no-brainer. I don't know how much growth potential there is, but it's a high-grade resource in British Columbia, with like 40 million ounces, and they've just started, I think, drilling. So, I mean, there are a ton of opportunities out there. Mayfair Gold recently put out a good hole. Stock is down to, I think, around 90 million Canadian market cap. I think they have around 15 or 20 million in cash. I'm not sure off the top of my head. And that's a proven resource already, and it looks like it could grow. TriStar Gold, super cheap. I mean, I could list a whole bunch of names, but if we're talking about some margin of safety, those are some, in my opinion, even though these are juniors, I mean, most of them aren't actual producers, etc., but they are the more conservative place in my portfolio.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're seeing a lot of opportunity out there, and even some of those stocks you just mentioned, it's interesting to see some of the fundamental value of just cash in the bank or shares that these companies hold that isn't really being reflected in some of these share prices. Again, these companies right now, there's a number of them that just aren't getting very much value or any value for their production, for their asset. It's just been a tough downtrend for some of these stocks. Yes, there are a couple that have bucked the trend, but broadly, there are a lot of stocks that have moved down. So, hey, Eric, always great chatting with you, buddy. I guess in full disclosure, I'm assuming that you hold all of those shares. I was trying to keep up with all of them. I hold Novo Resources. I know Shad holds Dolly Varden and Novo. I'll post a note within the weekend show posting if we own any others after I review this. But hey, overall, Eric, great chatting with you as always. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Okay, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am replaying an interview that we posted on Friday. It is a discussion with Mark Chandler, and it really looks big picture at the potential transitory nature of not just inflation, but also the reopening trade, also fiscal policy, also consumer spending, something that hasn't been discussed widely. So that's why I wanted to highlight this interview again for all of you listening on the weekend show. I hope you all enjoy this segment, and we are going to be back next segment with Richard Postma talking precious metals again. Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We are joined by Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog. Now, Mark, we were all chatting off mic, and some interesting concepts were being thrown around by you regarding this whole concept of transitory for inflation, but then taking that a step further to this reopening trade and consumer spending. Look, there's no denying that when the world was shut down, especially the U.S., North America broadly, people were cooped up. And when stuff starts opening, everyone really rushes out. There's this pent-up demand that there's no denying that that has already started to happen. So it's this whole reopen trade. But it ties in hand with inflation here, where you think there's a potential that all of this, inflation, the reopening trade, and consumer spending could be transitory, and we could have already seen the peak behind us because of the fact that at least some states have been open for months now. Take us through this general concept and how it could play also into currencies and markets, please.
Yeah, sure. So here's the big picture. Here's how I'm thinking it's evolving is that as the economy recovers, of course, we know about the base effect, and we know about the bottlenecks causing price increases. And as the economy opens, more activity, and as the economy opens, that means that this pent-up demand that we have in the household level, it means that the fiscal policy is the sort of peak is behind us. That is the government's support programs. The next step really is we have some new programs launching for family support, for child support in July, but the big packages are going to be gradually coming to an end. And so that some of that fiscal punch will be leaving. I'll give you an example of what that means is that this year, the Congressional Budget Office, this nonpartisan group of research for Congress, has the U.S. budget deficit at 13.5% of GDP. Next fiscal year, it falls below 5%. Now, I know 5% is still large, but that 8% decline, 8 percentage points of GDP, less fiscal support. So household demand, people like myself, who now we can go out in public and go to a ball game and go to stores, spending some money, that pent-up demand, that also is going to be exhausted. I mean, of course, we're still going to be going shopping and going to ball games, but that increase becomes much more stable. And so what I'm thinking is that the economy is either peaking now or going to peak in Q3. And that what we need to, it's not just prices that are going to be transitory, but this business cycle. I mean, we haven't repealed the business cycle. So again, from the Congressional Budget Office, this is what they're talking about. And again, they're nonpartisan. They've got growth this fiscal year, which ends in September, at 7.4%. Next year, they got slowing to 3.1%. And in 2023, 1.1%. So in the big picture, I've got the less monetary support, less fiscal support, the exhaustion or the satiation of the household demand. And then the other thing I'd point out, I know you're really interested in commodities, is I'm watching the price of oil. And it keeps going up. And it looks to me like the OPEC Plus group and the U.S. shale producers are showing a lot of restraint here in the face of, say, I think we hit $75 a barrel for August WTI. And what I notice is that, again, from a big picture point of view, is that before the past three business downturns in the U.S., oil prices doubled. And oil prices once again have doubled, not since last April when they were negative, and that was a fluke, but we just go since the vaccine. Oil prices have doubled, and they might not have peaked. I mean, I see a lot of calls for $100 a barrel for oil. And so when I put all these things together, I think this is the best things get. And that's what concerns me going forward. I think people are still thinking that somehow, because this business cycle was caused by the pandemic, that somehow we've repealed it. And I'm suggesting that just like prices are transitory, the price increases are transitory, growth, the business cycle hasn't been repealed. And this is probably the best that growth gets.
Well, Mark, that's an interesting point of view to take, and I haven't heard a lot of people talking about this, but if growth is transitory, and if we've seen kind of the biggest part of this push, or we're in the middle of the biggest part of this push in growth, do you think we're at risk then, and I hate even saying this, but are we at risk for a market correction? Because if the last few recessions have been preceded by a doubling of the oil price, if people are overly optimistic, and you mentioned off mic that a lot of businesses have invested in growth and they've poured a lot into it, expecting this continued rise in growth. If we don't see that, and if things taper off here, even just flatline, but worse, if they were to decrease over time, as those estimates indicate that year over year, we may start trending down. Are we at a risk for a real kind of market correction, deflationary type of event, a full-on recession that everybody's been asking about for a decade or more than a decade? Are we actually at this interesting place where we could see a legitimate recession?
Well, I think we could see a recession, an economic downturn, but what it means for the stock market is a different story. I'm not sure how anchored the stock market is to the economy. I think about what happened last year. A very strong stock market, a very weak economy. And so I wonder if the stock market just has a different function now than reflecting the economic tide. I mean, if I'm right in this business cycle, we might not get above 2% yield on the 10-year bond for a whole business cycle. Negative real interest rates. And what does that mean? To me, it means that people have little choice for most of us who choose between stocks and bonds. They have little choice but to stay in the stock market.
Well, I have one more question then about the commodities you brought up, Mark, because if the demand is not going to be there, and if China is dialing back a little bit its manufacturing of goods, and it's actually been dumping commodities in the market, it's been dumping metals into the market, and it's been doing strategic agreements where it's been supplying other businesses with its reserves, if there's going to be a slowdown in consumer demand, if on the other side of the equation, if the production coming out of the East is going to slow down, then won't the commodities get hit as a result of that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? I just don't know about, I'd want to unpack the commodities. I think that the grains right now are primarily weather driven. I think oil is driven by, the U.S. shale producers. And the OPEC is showing a lot of restraint given how high oil prices are. And I think they want to, they got control of the market. And so I think that, so if you tell me about commodities, which commodities, I'd say, yeah, maybe the metals, especially the industrial metals. I see copper is, even though some other metals are trading stronger, We've got a sort of copper looks a bit heavier, and I wonder if that's not if we break down commodities and just focus on those that are really used for industry, like the metals. Maybe there's where you see the weakness. And to your point, it does look like China is tapping into its own strategic reserves. Just like it's not so different than what the U.S. is talking about in order to have this infrastructure measure. One of the compromises is they would tap into U.S. strategic reserves, oil reserves. Same kind of concept, but China's just got more of these reserves and in the metals.
Mark, thanks as always for your time. Great chatting with you. I'll post a link below this interview to your blog, Mark2Market, and we'll chat again next week. Have a great long weekend, Mark.
Thank you. Good luck, everybody.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're continuing to focus on the resource and precious metals sector as we are now chatting with Richard Postma, aka Doc. And Doc, I know everyone wants to hear your updated thoughts on the metals, including silver. So we're going to get to silver, but first, when it comes to gold, look, this week was really boring for the gold market. Gold didn't really do much. The stocks, again, they didn't really do much either. And now that we are in July here, I guess the forecast for you, what are you thinking, Doc? Where does gold go from here? Because quite frankly, that month of June was really bad for the gold sector, down maybe $150. Where does gold go from here, Doc?
Well, May was great and everybody was hoping, and then June dashed the hopes. But I think July is going to be a boring month. I think we could have a little pressure for a week yet here, maybe a week and a half, and then we might move up a little bit, but don't expect any big rally here. We may end the month higher than June, but it's not, it shouldn't be fantastic. Now, what I'm finding interesting is on the monthly chart, if you look at the monthly chart, we have not had a closing month below the 20-month moving average of the Bollinger Bands, and that's positive. And we're sitting right on it right now in July already. The question is, are we going to stay above it on every month after now? And if we do, then we're moving into a bullish phase that's going to keep moving higher. However, if we close below that 20-month moving average in July or even in August or September, then we're going to be settling into a sideways pattern for quite a while. We could even go lower, a little lower. But that's not necessarily a negative because I think we're still set up going forward eventually to have a real significant move in the gold market. But if we close below the 20-month, people are going to have to be patient for some time.
So, Doc, what's your time frame then of when we could get another big move higher, let's say, in the gold market? Because right now, if you take a look at the shorter term charts, we've been in a 10-month correction with lower highs pretty consistently. And that last high, even after that 2-month rebound in gold, was another lower high. So short term, the downtrend is still there. Long term, uptrend is still intact. But when could we get that next leg higher?
If you want to talk about a big leg higher that we take out the highs in August, I'm afraid you're going to have to wait until at least 2022 because I think we have to work a little bit lower in the MACD. But the thing in the MACD is if you go back to 2011, 2012, when we the MACD moved down and the gold market moved down for some time, we took out neutral or the zero area and we wallowed under it for a number of months. Well, this time, I think when we move down in the MACD, we do not take out the zero. I don't think we go below it. I think we bottom out at the zero or a little bit above it potentially. to consolidate for the next big move. And so I think that's going to it's going to take us until 2022 to get down into that frame of reference where I think we really start to move higher to really take out, you know, this so-called double top. And some people talk about, you know, the cup and handle, where we take out the right side of the handle. I think we're going to have to wait until 2022 at least.
Well, Doc, it's interesting you bring up those chart patterns, the larger ones, the cup and handle and the potential double top. We hear a lot of technicians and a lot of generalists referencing these different patterns saying, hey, you know, it looks like a double top. It's down from here. And they're very bearish. Other people, hey, it's a cup and handle. It's a long-term bullish trend. It's going to go to the moon. When you're looking at these longer term patterns, not the daily noise and not even the weekly, but when you're looking at these monthly patterns, what gives you the confidence that regardless of whether we pull back for a month or two and then go up, or whether we pull back, you know, and kind of channel sideways the rest of the year and then go up next year, what gives you the confidence that we're still in a longer term bull trend and that eventually the next move higher could be that big move where we finally do break out? On the longer term charts, what gives you that feeling that, or that data that we're going to get there one day?
Well, I've looked at long-term charts for a long time in various asset classes, and I kind of studied those because I'm an investor and I'm a trend watcher. And like you said, I don't like to watch noise, the ups and downs, because I am not a day trader. So I like to position myself for those big moves. And the thing is, what it tells me is, number one, back in 2011 and 12, when we went underneath that zero point that I talk about, often you'll see in asset classes and long-term charts that the next time you move up and you move down, it doesn't go as deep in the move. And the other thing that tells me that is, if you look at the strength indicators, they are not moving down much at all. That tells you there's underlying strength in this market that people aren't realizing. And that's another positive. And the other thing I'm watching is the 200-month moving average, which back in 2011 and 12, we separated from that considerably. And we did not start moving up until that 200-month moving average got close to pricing. Well, we're about to move higher and higher with that. And as we move up over the next few months with that, that's going to be a very significant support area. And if we get close to that, I think that's another thing that's going to propel us higher.
All right, Doc, let's also talk about silver, because silver, curiously enough, has been really boring. Actually, a range-bound trade in the last 10 months. As gold has corrected, silver has stayed within this about $9 range, let's say about $21 up to $30. And, it's actually put in higher lows pretty consistently here throughout this 10-month period. Some mixed highs in there, but why, in your eyes, is silver a lot more boring than gold when typically it is the more volatile and more exciting out of the two of those precious metals?
Well, I think silver's starting to act like a commodity more than a precious metal right now. And, you know, you're seeing pullbacks on copper. You're starting to see the commodity market get broken here a little bit. Look at timber or lumber. Lumber is just getting crushed right now. And I think we're just pulling back on some of these commodities for a while. Because we're starting, we see the beginnings of a long-term commodity bull market, I believe. And so I think silver is acting more like a commodity now than it is a precious metal. And that's why you're seeing it. And if you look at the monthly chart, it's pulled away from the upper Bollinger band. And I think we're going to move sideways to a little bit down for silver. But I don't think silver is going to get crushed here. But we could trade within the 20 to 25 range for some time, but it's acting more like a commodity, I think. And so when we start to see the other commodities get their second leg higher, I think silver will move with it as a commodity.
Well, Doc, that's an interesting point on silver acting more like a commodity, that kind of that base metal factor it has, industrial metal versus the precious metal side of it. But longer term, you know, if we look at longer term charts, which you're a fan of, generally, silver will track gold. over long periods of time. And so if gold is selling off, you know, I would have expected silver just to get smashed in this recent pullback in gold along with it, but it hasn't. But in the commodity sector, there's been a lot of cross currents. There's the inflation argument. There's the reopening trade. There's the China, you know, buying and stockpiling minerals. And then right now, China is dumping them back on the market, which is pressuring the price. Do you think there's going to be a point where silver decouples again from its link to commodities and eventually acts more like a precious metal? And will it be the move higher in gold that finally wakes it up in that sense?
Oh, absolutely. Because when you can't, when gold gets going, silver just doesn't sit still. In fact, silver will often lead. Silver's got something really good going for it right now, since it has that dual purpose of commodity and precious metal, because we know all about the money printing that we're seeing, and that's not going to stop. And we know that ultimately that monetary base that keeps increasing, eventually we're going to have to see velocity. And when we see that, gold is going to have, I think, the big run everybody's waiting for. And silver is just going to move right along with gold. Plus, it's got that commodity impact. And I think we're going to see all commodities do well in the future. So silver, I love the way silver is acting, frankly. But it will move when gold does as well, and it'll move really, I think, in a very bullish way this next time.
Doc, let's talk about the stocks then, either gold or silver stocks or any other resource stocks. One of my biggest takeaways outside of, let's say, money printing or that inflation argument is the fact that companies, gold companies, silver companies, explorers up to the majors, they are well cashed up. I haven't seen an environment like this where the companies have this much money really since the maybe peak of the last market. But this is a very different environment where gold has trended down for 10 months and we still have seen a ton of financings and a lot of companies that I think have some good work plans. So that's encouraging for me. But again, when it comes to the stocks for you, where are you looking? What are you liking? Are you buying right now?
Yeah, I bought a little bit for the first time in a long time this past week. I started to dip and I started to purchase stocks that I had sold a while back. For instance, Yamana, where I had a really nice profit a number of months ago, and where Yamana is starting to come back. I'm looking at, I bought a little bit of IM Gold again. What I'm watching on those are their relationships to the Bollinger Bands on the monthly chart. I just love it when they approach their long-term Bollinger Bands, the lower one, because I keep nibbling every time these stocks get down to it. I've been starting to purchase again on this pullback, and I think we might have a week, like I said, week or a week and a half yet down, hanging down here, and I think we get a rally again, but it's not going to go to the moon. We're going to be in this channel, but every time I encourage people, every time we move down like this, purchase a little bit, because you won't regret it in the future. But that's what I've been doing, Corey, because so many of these are starting to approach their lower Bollinger Bands on the monthly chart, which are great support. And that's when I purchase a little bit again.
Care to share any names with us, Doc? What's top of your list, or what are you liking right now, please?
I'm buying about everything that explorers, mid-tiers. I don't buy a lot of the big boys like Newmont and those type of stocks. I like the mid-tiers. I like the ones that show potential of expanding their production. And one that I own that has gotten crushed later, and I've held it for a long time, is Equinox. And, with that blocking of their mine in Mexico, that didn't do us any favor. But I think they'll solve that problem. And I'll be adding to Equinox on this pullback. I just keep purchasing a little bit more. I like Sandstorm, and that's going to pull back. I like Nomad Royalty here. They pulled back a little bit. And I'm looking for Metallic finally, because I've been waiting to buy that. And that stock, Metallo Royalty and Streaming, that's pulling back, and that's another one I'm waiting to take initial position in. But I think that has further to fall, frankly, over the next few months. That's looking really technically problematic right now, Metallo Royalty and Streaming. And so I've been buying a lot of the explorers as well, and when they get technically in a range I like, and that's what I've been doing.
Okay, Doc, great having you on the show. Thanks for wrapping up this first hour and sharing your thoughts on, well, where gold and silver are going, plus some of the stocks. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Be sure to check out our website, kereport.com. Listen to all the editorials and company updates that we did throughout the week. I hope everybody down in the U.S. has a very happy 4th of July. A great long weekend. We'll be back next week. More coverage on markets and metals and a lot of the companies that all of you guys are asking about and following along with. Everyone, thanks for your time. Doc, really appreciate it. Have a great long weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.